All right, so good morning. This is Bio 231, and it's August 19th. And thank you so much for your help passing those things around. So what was passed out today were some extra copies of a syllabus if you needed it, and the study guide for exam one. And it tells you what questions at the end of the chapter you have to pay attention to, what exam figures you have to pay attention to, and you can start labeling these things. You might want to make some photocopies of this before you start labeling. Or, you know, you can put post-its over the lead lines, and you know, and you can do that with your book if you want. You could hide the answers and then say the answer in your mind and lift up the post-it and see. Okay, but that's what's going to be on the test. Here are some opportunities for SI. Don't forget, consistent attendance at SI usually raises somebody's grade 1 to 1.5 letter grades, right? Because you get to use the information. So even if you're shy, go and speak up, because a lot of times when you speak something, that helps you incorporate the information. And of course, saying something helps you with spelling as well, right? So the more activities you can get involved with, the easier it will be to know these things. All right, so I tried to check before everybody came in their weekly study plan. I'm pretty serious about that. I want you to show your lab instructors and the pre-lecture reading assignment. Make sure you get those done before I give a lecture on it. And then that will make the lecture have a lot of meaning for you, because you learn some of the basic terminology, so it just doesn't go right over your head, right? So if I start speaking in a foreign language to you and you've never heard that foreign language before, what kind of conversation are we going to have? Well, it's going to be meaningless, right? But if you get to study that foreign language just a little bit, right, we can have a little bit of a conversation, right? So the pre-lecture reading assignment gets you on the right track right away. All right, only officially registered students, please, in class, yeah? Okay, so we were talking about two different kinds of membranes last time, and these are the most ubiquitous. We find membranes all over the body, but these are the two major kinds. We find little cavities all over the body, but the major cavities are going to be lined or covered with a membrane. And so there are two general classes of membranes. There's mucous membranes and serous membranes. And does anybody know a definition for a mucous membrane? I think I mentioned this last time. Yes, it's a membrane that lines a cavity, and that cavity has to be open to the outside world. And a good example of that would be? Yeah, oral cavity. Yeah, you could say mouth, but we'll use an anatomical term. Oral cavity, nasal cavity, right? The alimentary canal, that's a digestive tract. Parts of the reproductive tract are open to the outside world. And they're lined with a mucous membrane. And some mucous membranes secrete mucus onto that surface, but that's really not the definition. That's not how we categorize it. It all depends on where it is in the body and if that cavity is open to the outside world. All right, a serous membrane, on the other hand, lines a cavity that's not open to the outside world. And we looked at a number of them last time. And does anybody have an example of a cavity that's not open to the outside world? Like the brain's not open to the outside world. For sure, you don't want that open to the outside world. That's the cranial cavity, the vertebral cavity around the spinal cord, and then, of course, everything in the thoracic cavity, like the lungs are surrounded by a serous membrane, and the abdominal cavity and pelvic cavity. Those would be some really good examples. I think I have to lecture from down here so that I can see the screen. All right, and a serous membrane is a lot different than a mucous membrane, because a mucous membrane only has one compartment to it. It's just made up of the membrane itself. Yeah? Is it on the screen?
No, it is on the screen. Where is it on
our handout? Oh, you don't have it in your handout? Ah, write it down. I don't know what. I'm still on module one. This is the last part of module one. Okay, so a serous membrane is a little bit more complicated. There's three important parts to a serous membrane. There is the part of the membrane that is lining the body cavity, that's on the wall of the body cavity. And we call this the parietal. division of the serous membrane. Then there's another division that I'm going to skip. And then the third division is the part of the membrane that actually lies right on the organ that's inside that cavity. So if it's the pleural cavity, what organ are we talking about? It's the lungs. So there is a membrane right on the surface of the lungs, and we call that the visceral division. The visceral division. And there's a space between the body wall and the organ, and that's filled with serous fluid. That's the serous cavity filled with serous fluid. So that serous fluid allows your organs to slip and slide around a little bit. It reduces friction, all right? So it defeats inflammation. So that's important to have that serous fluid in there. Okay. So did you copy that down? So let's take a look at some serous membranes. And the best way to think of a serous membrane is think of holding a balloon, okay? And it's just a single surface, a single spherical surface. And now let's poke something inside the balloon, like your finger. Or in this particular example, somebody's sticking their hand inside the balloon and you don't burst the balloon, right? So now what do you have? You have your hand kind of inside the balloon, right? But it's covered with a part of the balloon, right? So this would be an example. The inner wall of the balloon right here would be the visceral serous membrane. And then the part of the balloon that still is remaining on the outside, this would be the parietal part of the serous membrane. And can you see that there's a space between the visceral part and the parietal part that has air in it, right? And so this would be the serous cavity filled with serous fluid. So the serous membrane is continuous, can you see? Because this is all just one surface of the balloon, but it folds back and forth to cover a visceral organ like this. So we have to, since this part of the serous membrane is different than over here, we got to give it two different names. And plus, don't forget about the serous fluid between them. All right, so let's look at a good example. All right, so what cavity are we looking at right here? It contains the heart. So this is the pericardial cavity. And we see, let's really zoom in. So this is the pericardium. So right on the surface of the heart is a membrane. And the heart is not open to the outside world, so is that a mucus or serous membrane? It's a serous membrane. The one right on the surface of the organ is what we call the visceral pericardium. And you can see that it is continuous with the membrane that lines that cavity. So this would be the parietal pericardium. And the space in between is filled with sometimes what we call pericardial fluid, which is a serous fluid. And that just decreases the inflammation because what is that heart doing inside your chest all the time? It's pounding around in there, actually fairly violently. It's a very strong muscle, right? So that just decreases inflammation. But you know what? You can get an infection of this space. Anybody know what an infection of this pericardial space is called? Pericarditis. That's really serious. And so the serous fluid here, or the serous cavity, fills up with fluid. And as this space right here fills up with fluid, guess what happens to the heart? As that space gets filled up, what happens to the heart? It gets compressed, right? It shrinks down. And that's really serious because in order for the heart to pump blood, what has to happen first? The blood has to be able to get into the heart in order for the heart to pump it. And if the heart is compressed, it might relax, but blood won't flow in. So when it contracts, it's not pumping any blood at all. And so no one in here would like to have a heart that's pumping but not pumping blood. Okay, so pericarditis is really serious. All right, so how would you deal with that? You can deal with it very quickly. First, you want to be able to treat that infection, but the patient might not live long enough. Yeah. Yeah, you jab a needle in somebody's pericardial space right here and just aspirate that fluid out so that you can get that heart function back right away. Okay? Sounds easier than it is. Okay. All right, so that's the pericardial space, serous membrane. Here is the serous membrane around the the lungs. All right, so here is the membrane right on the surface of the lungs. What would you call that? That is the visceral pleural membrane. Visceral pleural membrane. And this one right here by the cursor, that's the parietal division. Notice that they're continuous with each other. They fold right here. And you have serous fluid between the visceral and the parietal division of the pleural membranes. And again, you can get an infection of this space. What's that called? Anybody know what that's called? That's called pleurisy. Pleurisy. And that's a very painful condition, right? It hurts so much that people don't want to breathe. Well, what's it like when you can't breathe? How do you feel when you can't breathe? Well, you feel miserable, right? Because breathing is a very good thing for you to do, all right? But when you try to breathe to overcome that nasty feeling that you have, it feels like somebody's stabbing you in the chest, all right? And so patients are really miserable because they have two choices. Feel pain like you're being stabbed in the chest or feel like you're being choked to death. So which would you choose? Well, that's a real difficult choice, right? You would like not to feel either of those things, right? So patients are really miserable. And so when somebody's in intractable pain, what do we like to do for people that are in that kind of pain? We like to prescribe opiates, right? So that they don't feel that pain, so that they can breathe and makes them feel much better. But again, you need to fight that infection with some kind of antibiotic or find out whatever it is. Okay, so that's some interesting things about a serous membrane. But don't forget the peritoneum. How would you maybe describe, what cavities make up the peritoneal cavity? The abdominal cavity is one, and the pelvic cavity is the other. If you put them together because they're a continuous cavity, we call that the peritoneum. There's a serous membrane around all of these visceral organs in the peritoneal cavity. For instance, like stomach and liver and things like that, right? And we have a serous membrane here as well. So the one on the body wall is the parietal division. The one that's on the surface of these organs is the visceral division. And here is that serous fluid between them. And you can have an infection. Maybe if somebody has an appendicitis and that appendix bursts and it releases all of these bacteria into the peritoneum, guess what we call that? That's a peritonitis, right? And you'll feel really miserable. You'll probably feel like you want to die. And sometimes you don't if it's not treated. But, of course, that's really serious. You should be treated for that. So appendicitis is a real serious condition. But you can live through it. Notice the kidneys right here. When we get to the urinary system, which is a couple months down the road, notice that the kidneys don't have a serous membrane around them. They're actually posterior to the peritoneal cavity. They're outside the peritoneal cavity. And so we just sometimes call them retroperitoneal as a result of that, because they're embedded in muscles and fat pads to protect the kidneys. They're not really in the peritoneal cavity. Okay. So I think this is it for chapter one. Yeah, that's it for chapter one. Okay. So who's got some questions about chapter one? If you didn't do that pre-lecture reading assignment, you know, but if you have it with you, start filling these things out during lecture, right? Maybe you have to take some notes with that. Okay, let's move on to cells. And the study of cells, what do we call the study of cells, scientific study of cells and cell function? That is cytology. So if we're just interested in looking at one cell, that would be cytology. And the cell is the structural and functional unit of life. And what that means is that in order for you to understand life, which is why everybody's here, you got to know something about a cell. And a cell is something really small, so that's why we start to talk about a cell at this point in the class, because we're interested in understanding small pieces, small building blocks of the human body, right? Okay, so a lot of times I'll mention the structural and functional unit of something, and it should conjure up a bunch of images of your mind. And if you understand the structural and functional unit of something, then you know how something much more complicated works. All right, so the cell is the structural and functional unit of life. That means that if anything's alive, it has to be made out of, it's got to be made out of cells. A cell is the basic building block of life. Okay, so we're really interested in cells. Some organisms are unicellular. That means what? They just are made up of one cell. Has anybody ever taken a biology class, and could anybody tell me a name of a unicellular organism besides your brother and sister? Just kidding. What's the name of a unicellular organism? Like amoeba is a really good example, right? That's a standalone organism, okay? But humans are composed of trillions of cells, right? That's millions and millions and millions. And therefore, we're, what, multicellular organisms, right? And in order to understand a cell, we want to break it down into smaller pieces. We want to look at the building blocks that are necessary to make a cell, and we look at the structural organization, the hierarchical organization map. And so you should already know what the basic building block of a cell is. What's a basic building block of a cell? Okay. Can anybody look at that diagram? I think that's figure 1.1. 1.1. Okay. And that is an organelle. So we're going to actually start looking at some organelles in here. And we're going to look at all the possible organelles a cell can have. And in order to have a cell, we got to put some of those organelles in there. Okay. 2.1. Yeah, because this is the second chapter. All right, so the first organelle that we're going to look at is something called the plasma membrane. A plasma membrane separates, it surrounds the cell on the outside, so it's neither a mucous membrane or a serous membrane. It's particular just to a cell. And there are some organelles inside the cell that have that basic kind of membrane surrounding them as well. All right, so another name for plasma membrane is cell membrane. It separates the extracellular substances from the intracellular substances. And that's really important because everything that's inside the cell is alive. It's functioning as a living system, but things outside of cells are, you know, it's just a dead system out there. There's nothing happening in this air here. That's alive unless it's within a cell. So the membrane acts as a barrier that selects what can enter or leave a cell. So it allows good things to enter, things that support life, and it wants to secrete things that are harmful to the cell to get rid of it. So excretion is an important function. All right, so the best way to think of a membrane, the simplest way, and this is a good building block to appreciate, is that a membrane is made out of a single kind of molecule. The basic structure is made from a single molecule called phospholipid. And to make a membrane, we need two layers of phospholipids. So let me show you what a picture of this looks like. All right, so here is a nice picture of a cell. We're going to understand and recognize these organelles by their structure and then figure out what kind of function they have. But first, what we want to look at is what does this membrane that surrounds the cell, what does it really look like? Okay, so this is what it looks like if we really zoom into it. And we see, if we look just in this region right here, can in your mind's eye, can you picture like two layers, one on top of the other? Can you picture two layers? So here's the first layer from here to here, and then here's the second layer from here to here. And this is what we call a phospholipid. The phosphate part are what we call these head groups. These are the parts that like to be surrounded by water. And these little legs or tails that are sticking down from the phosphate group, that's the lipid part. And what can you tell, what kind of molecule is lipid? What's another way of talking about a lipid? What's a lipid? It's a fat or an oil. And what can you tell me about fat or oil? Maybe you made some toast this morning and put some butter on it and it dropped out of your hand because you weren't quite awake yet. And it fell out of your hand and it fell on your pants or your dress or whatever. So how does toast always fall when you have butter on it, it seems? Butter side down. So now you got butter on your clothes. Okay. Can you just get a wet paper towel that has water on it and clean your pants off? No. So what can you tell me about lipids and water? Do they like to mix? No, they don't like to mix, right? Okay. So that's why this membrane forms. These lipid parts get stuck in the middle because they like each other. These are what we call the hydrophobic region. They don't like water. But the phosphate groups over here, have a lot of electrical charges on them. They like to be surrounded by water. So the membrane has these two different natures, a lipid nature on the inside and a water nature on the outside, and it makes these two layers. So sometimes when we think about membrane, we just talk about it in terms of the phospholipid bilayer. A lot of substances that are in our body are dissolved in water, right? They like to be in water, but because the inner part of the membrane is lipid, most substances can't get across the phospholipid bilayer, right? Just like you can't clean your clothes that have oil on them with a wet paper towel, things that like water just can't move across the membrane because they can't get through that barrier right there. All right, so the basic structure is a phospholipid bilayer, but to make the membrane work really nicely, there have to be passageways so that molecules can move one way or two ways across the membrane. And these things are what we call channels. So these are proteins that can actually partly dissolve in the lipid and partly dissolve in the water part of the cell, and you see a passageway. All right, so that's a channel. And the cell can control these channels. This one over here, the channel is open all the time. This channel over here, notice, what can you tell me about this channel? Is it open or closed? Well, it's being blocked by something, right? So this particular channel is closed, and the cell has the ability to open and close channels depending on the needs of the cell. All right, what other things do we have in the basic phospholipid bilayer? We have these other molecules. These are cholesterol molecules that are necessary to stabilize the phospholipid bilayer, because the phospholipid bilayer is so wiggly that if you didn't have these other components to stabilize it, when you stood up, all of your membranes would just drip on the floor. Okay? So these things help solidify the membrane to make it a little bit more solid. So what have you heard about cholesterol? Is it good or bad?
Both.
Yeah, both. That's really good. Right? You can't say really bad because you need it to make membranes. Right? You need it in there to stabilize your membrane so that you don't leak out all over the floor. All right? But if you have too much, that's bad. We'll talk about that later in the class. There's other reasons why you want to have cholesterol in your body too. But again, not too much. All right. So these are proteins right here. Some proteins have other kinds of molecules sticking on them. These things that look like stop signs, these are sugar molecules. And sugar molecules like to branch, form these branching patterns. And these are what we call antigens, and a glycoprotein just means that it's a protein that has a sugar molecule attached to it. The branching pattern will designate this particular cell as belonging to a particular individual. So all of your cells have a particular shaped antigen on there, and so your body knows that that cell belongs to you. And if another cell enters your body, and this antigen has a different shape, your body knows what? It doesn't belong in you. And so what is your body going to do to a cell that it knows doesn't belong to you because it doesn't have the right shaped antigen on it? It's going to try to get rid of it, try to kill it somehow, right? It's going to reject that cell because it might be an infectious cell or some kind of mutant cell, maybe a tumor cell or something like that. Okay, so your immune system can recognize all of your cells by these specifically shaped glycoproteins that are on the cell. Membranes also have receptor molecules, so they can listen to other cells in their body. So a distant cell might send out a signal, a chemical messenger, and it can bind to the membrane and it can change the metabolism, the behavior of this cell. A good example of a molecule that's a signaling molecule that's coming from faraway place would be a hormone. So various hormones can signal other cells to do things if they have a receptor, and that's a protein that's placed in the plasma membrane. The proteins that are embedded in the membrane, these are what we call integral proteins, because if we take them out, guess what we do? We break the membrane up. Right? These other proteins that we see down over here holding everything together, these are what we call peripheral proteins, and we can design chemical means to remove these proteins, and when we do, we don't necessarily have to destroy the membrane. So that's what we call a peripheral protein. And some of these peripheral proteins help give cells their shape. They act like a little skeleton inside the cell. So you'll see some cells are flat, some are cuboidal, they look like a square, some are columnar, kind of look like that column right there. And it's these peripheral proteins, These filaments of the cytoskeleton that can be used to give the cell its shape. So finally, in closing, one model, the basic and the simplest way to think of the plasma membrane is as a phospholipid, how many layers? Bilayer, yeah, phospholipid bilayer, but a bit more sophisticated understanding of the plasma membrane is to realize that things can be inserted into the plasma membrane to give it special kinds of function for cell recognition, for communication, for transport of materials across the cell membrane. So the best way, really, the most sophisticated way to think of the plasma membrane is the fluid mosaic model. Fluid because the phospholipid bilayer is very fluid, but mosaic because what? We add a lot of other pieces to that membrane to give it these special attributes or functions. Okay, so try to remember those two models of thinking of any kind of membrane. All membranes will be phospholipid bilayers, and depending on the particular membrane, the mosaic nature is going to change. It will have different components inserted into the membrane. Okay, so here are all the things that could be in there. I didn't mention a pump. A pump is kind of interesting because it can use energy to actually sequester compounds in your body. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. All right, rough endoplasmic reticulum. Rough ER, hardly anybody says rough endoplasmic reticulum. All right, so we're done talking about the plasma membrane. The rough endoplasmic reticulum are these structures right here. Let me give you another important landmark. This big membrane-bound structure inside the cell is the nucleus. The nucleus contains the genetic material of the cell. This is the blueprint on how to build your body, and it controls all the activity of the cell, so it's a very important organelle. Surrounding the nucleus, see it kind of curves around the nucleus, this is endoplasmic reticulum. And in particular, it has these little structures on it that make it look like sandpaper. So guess what we call that? Rough endoplasmic reticulum. And these little dots right here are what we call ribosomes. And ribosomes are important for protein synthesis, the stage of protein synthesis. So the function of rough ER is to make proteins because it has these ribosomes. If you have endoplasmic reticulum, like we have right here, it's just a system of membranes, and you see ribosomes. You see ribosomes on this ER? I don't know. I don't see it on my screen. Yours is flickering a little bit. Hopefully it won't go out. We call this smooth endoplasmic reticulum, and because it does not have ribosomes, what can't it do? It can't make proteins. All right, but it has a function. It makes lipids. All right, so it makes lipids. That's an important function. Smooth endoplasmic reticulum can also store an important ion in our body, namely calcium. That's another bullet point that you should be aware of. All right, so rough ER, protein synthesis, smooth ER, lipid synthesis, and store calcium. What's calcium good for? Have you ever heard of calcium? Yeah, what's it good for? Making strong bones. Yeah, you don't want your bones to break just by walking around or moving, right? So you need to have strong bones. Okay. So, let's see, another organelle, this one right here. It has a number of membranes around it. This is what we call a mitochondrion. And the membranes on the inside we call Christie membranes. Here's the outer mitochondrial membrane, here's the inner one. And the job of the mitochondria is to take a nutrient, specifically, we could name a couple, but one really good example would be glucose, that's a sugar, and convert the energy in sugar into a form of energy that can be used by all of the cell's processes, and that molecule is called ATP. So the job of mitochondria is to make ATP. That's the energy molecule. And without ATP, what happens to the cell? It dies, right? So this mitochondria has a really important job. In order to make ATP from glucose efficiently, mitochondria need oxygen. So what does that tell you about what you're doing right now? What are you doing right now to get oxygen to the all those millions and billions, probably billions of mitochondria that you have? What are you doing? You're breathing, right, to get oxygen to them so that they can make ATP. All right, so that's an incredibly important function. And there's one organ, well, there's a number of organs in your body that are highly metabolic, meaning that they need a lot of ATP, just to give you a feeling for how important ATP is. All right, and that organ is your brain, because it's controlling all the processes in your body by sending out electrical information through your nervous system. All right, so, and don't forget, mitochondria need oxygen to make ATP. How many minutes or hours or seconds of consciousness do you have if we cut off oxygen supply to these mitochondria in your brain? Okay, because your consciousness comes from your brain. Your awareness comes from your brain. If we cut off oxygen to your brain, when does your brain run out of energy, basically, because there's not enough ATP in there? How long does that take? Okay, I hear a couple minutes here and there. And the real answer is about 3 seconds. Okay, so those mitochondria have to be pumping out ATP all the time. So if your heart stops pumping in 3 seconds, you're unconscious. You have no idea what's going on. Your brain still can be revived, all right, if we get somebody's heart started. But if you don't start somebody's heart and we don't get oxygen to the brain is going to die. How long do you have to revive somebody before their brain is dead? And when I say dead, what does that mean? Can't come back to life, right? It's an irreversible process. How long do we have to help somebody? Okay, that's really close. You're right in the ballpark. But to make it simple, I say 3 seconds and you go unconscious, and then in 3 minutes, your brain dead. Okay, but some people, you know, maybe if they're athletic or whatever, you might be able to extend it out to 6 minutes, but that's really way out on the far side. Neonates or newborn babies, they can go a really long time. We're not exactly sure why that is. And people fall like into an icy pond or lake, and they've been able to be revived, I think, even after an hour. That's really a rare circumstance. So there are exceptions to that rule, but your brain runs out of ATP in 3 seconds, and if you don't get oxygen to it in 3 minutes, basically it's probably never going to come back again. So how can you help somebody whose heart is not beating and their brain is running out of energy? What can you do to help somebody? Anybody know CPR in here, certified in CPR? Yeah, excellent. Okay. And so how do you help somebody whose heart is not beating? You can beat their heart for them by doing what? Chest compressions, right? Okay. And you can do mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to oxygenate their blood for them. So that's what CPR is for, to beat somebody's heart whose heart is stopped and to oxygenate their blood to keep their brain healthy. Okay. Now, I just want to tell you guys that are CPR certified that I have a different kind of brain. My brain won't die after 3 minutes. It won't die for about 6 hours, right? So don't stop CPR on me even after 3 minutes, okay? I'm sort of kidding. All right, another way to think about ATP is, well, how much does your whole body need, right, in terms of a weight? So if we think of an average-sized person, a textbook-sized person, we say 70 kilograms. We don't really work in kilograms every day in our everyday life. But if you just think of somebody as 70 kilograms, how much ATP does a person need to stay alive in terms of weight? And the answer is 40 kilograms of ATP a day. So more than half your body weight you burn up, all right, to keep yourself alive. It doesn't mean that your body needs to carry a luggage of 40 kilograms. What your body does is that when it burns up in ATP, what happens? Look at this guy right here. What's that? It's a mitochondria. It takes the breakdown products and it resynthesizes the ATP right away so you don't run out of energy. But in order for that to happen, you need to nourish yourself. You need to have glucose and oxygen in order for that to happen. So as soon as you use up an ATP, it's made again so that you don't die. And if you were to add up all the ATP that's used, that's 40 kilograms. So how much ATP does your body make every day? It has to make the amount that you use up, which is 40 kilograms. That's a huge number. That's more than half your body weight. All right, so that's the importance of this organelle right here. The other interesting thing about this organelle, and you should follow up with reading it in your text, is that if you've ever taken a microbiology class and look at this mitochondria, it doesn't look like it's anything human. It actually looks like a bacterium. Okay, and this is a pretty well accepted theory right now that a mitochondria at one time was a free living bacterium, that infected a line of cells that were similar to human cells, and they formed a symbiosis. All right, so these human-like cells got the benefit from this bacteria. What's the benefit that this bacteria is imparting to the human cell? It's making ATP. Yeah, that's really a fantastic thing. That's a really good deal for our human cells. But if it's a symbiosis, this bacteria has to be getting something from the human host. What's it getting from the human host? Usually, if we're healthy, we're giving it oxygen. It loves oxygen because then it's happy to make ATP. And can anybody think of something else that we're providing for these invaders of our cells? Okay, yeah, we're giving it glucose as well, so we're feeding it with glucose and oxygen through our cardiovascular system. But there's something else too. Okay, since this is a living kind of organism, it actually has its own chromosome. It has its own DNA in there. And it replicates and does its own little living thing inside the cell according to its own schedule. Okay, so if it's alive, it can die. And things can predate upon it. They can eat mitochondria. But if it's inside your cells, right, it finds protection, right? Because then it uses the host's immune system so that it doesn't get eaten in the outside world. So we call that the endosymbiont theory of mitochondria. So that's fascinating. It actually blows a lot of people's minds when they first think about it, okay? All right, so that's mitochondria. Talked a lot about mitochondria. All right, what about some other things? We've got smooth ER, rough ER. What's the job of rough ER again? Protein synthesis. It's going to make proteins. That's one kind of important biomolecule. And some of those proteins have to be modified. So they're packaged. So proteins are made by the ribosomes, and they end up inside the rough endoplasmic reticulum behind these membranes. And then the rough ER pinches off into a vesicle. See these little balls right here? These are vesicles lined with a membrane. And the proteins that are made by rough ER are inside them, so they can't float around everywhere inside the cell. And then they end up over in this structure right over here. This is a Golgi body or Golgi apparatus. All right, remember I said some things have different names depending on who's talking about it? So here is an example. If I have Golgi body on the test, you should also be able to recognize what? Golgi apparatus, exactly the same kind of thing. So when proteins get into the Golgi apparatus right here, they're modified. Maybe a protein is added to them, or maybe a lipid molecule is added to them. So they change their nature, they're somehow modified, and then furthermore, they're packaged after modification into a vesicle, and this vesicle can stay inside the cell, or it can move over to the cell membrane, fuse with the cell membrane, and then whatever inside this vesicle gets released to the outside of the cell, and that process we call secretion. So that would be an example of a secretory pathway where a protein is made by rough ER. It moves over to the Golgi body where it's modified and packaged into a secretory vesicle for secretion. That's a secretory pathway. Okay. So again, just a really simple understanding of rough ER is, the function of rough ER is protein synthesis. Smooth ER is lipid synthesis. And if you want to say calcium storage, that's great. Golgi body would be modification and packaging. Just have these bullet points in your mind, okay? And then mitochondria. What do mitochondria do? Make ATP or make energy for the cell, right? Okay. We can also see some microtubules in this diagram right here that gives the cell its shape. But these microtubules can also attach themselves to vesicles. So a vesicle can hop a ride on a microtubule and move around in the cell. So a microtubule is like a little monorail, like a little train system, train network inside the cell for moving things around. And what controls the microtubules are these centrioles right here. So centrioles act as a place for organizing the microtubules and controlling where organelles move around inside the cell. We're going to see another important function of centrioles in just a little bit. And they're always found in pairs, and they're always kind of perpendicular to each other, and they are made out of microtubules and microfilaments. Okay, so that's why you can see all of those little microtubules in there. Okay, sometimes we have a vesicle that's a secretory vesicle like what we see right over here. Other times we might have a vesicle that has a certain kind of protein in there that is a digestive enzyme. All right, so there are proteins that can digest things, break things down into smaller particles. And these are what we call lysosomes. So lysosome is a vesicle that digests things. So if a virus gets into the cell, and if the cell is smart enough to put it inside this lysosome right here, what happens to that little infectious virus? It gets digested, okay, and then it can't infect the cell. So that's a way for the cell to protect itself. So the lysosome contains the protein lysozyme. Lysozyme is the active element that can break things down. Okay. Other vesicles right here. I can tell that it's a little bit different color, but it's got a different name, peroxisome. It has other kinds of enzymes in it. It's not important for digestion, but sometimes the cell, through its normal processing, makes a toxic compound, and that toxic compound can be detoxified by a peroxisome. So the function of a peroxisome is detoxification. Right, so I want you to know these good bullet points for these various organelles. Okay. We see some projections sticking off the surface of the cell right here. We have microvilli, and microvilli is a way for the cell to absorb material. It enhances absorption. When we get to digestive tract, absorption is going to be a very important function, and we're going to see cells of the digestive tract have what on them? These microvilli, you'll see those in lab as well. Another kind of cell, another kind of projection. I don't see it on this slide. They're maybe about 3 or 4 times as long as these microvilli. They have filaments in there. They're called cilia. And cilia are projections off of a cell surface, and they can move. And they all sweep like this. Right, so their function is what we call motility, or motion. So the cells that line your respiratory tract, like your trachea, have cilia. They're sweeping so that when we breathe in dust particles and bacteria, they're sweeping these particles which way, up or down? Would you think? I kind of hear both, up and down. Actually, they're sweeping up to get them up out of your body. Right, so they sweep all that garbage that's in your lungs and trachea up into your mouth, and then what do you do? No, then you just swallow it down. Okay. Unless you're a baseball player. Oh, is there a baseball player in here? Maybe. If you're a baseball player, then what do you do? Then you spit it out. Okay. But most people just swallow that stuff down with saliva. I think we make about 0.5 liter of saliva a day in our mouth. That's quite a bit. Okay. Nice, interesting little statistic. Okay, there's another projection that comes off of a cell, which is probably 100 times as big as a microvilli. It's really, really long. And its function, again, is motility. And only males have cells with these organelles. Okay? And it beats around, what's that called? Anybody know what that's called? Too bad it's not on this slide. It's called a flagellum. So a flagellum is like a gigantic cilium. And human cells only have one. And it's on a sperm cell, so sperms are highly motile because that flagella can beat around and a sperm can swim around through an aqueous or a watery environment as long as the pH is okay and as long as it doesn't run out of energy. All right, so those are some features on the cell surface. Now, what did I forget about the cell? Okay. We didn't talk about the nucleus yet. So here is the nucleus. It's surrounded by a membrane. What's the basic structure of this membrane right here around the nucleus? How would you describe that to somebody? The basic fundamental structure of this membrane around the nucleus. It would be called the phospholipid bilayer. Right? So there's a phospholipid bilayer around the nucleus that's separating all the stuff inside the nucleus from the outside of the nucleus. All of this material that's outside the nucleus but inside the plasma membrane is what we call cytoplasm. So cytoplasm is all the living junk inside the cell. And cytoplasm has got two components to it. It's got organelles, and then the watery part is what we call cytosol. All right, so cytosol is just the watery part of cytoplasm, and the other part would be what? Organelles. Okay. All right, so let's talk about this nucleus right here. It contains genetic material, which is made out of DNA, and DNA is arranged into chromosomes, which are huge molecules. And if you were to take all the DNA out of your body and unwind it and string it from end to end, guess how far it would reach? It would reach 250,000 miles, which is the distance between here and the moon. That's because we have trillions of cells and these molecules are extremely long. All right, so that's all the information that we have, a huge amount of information in all of our cells. Okay, so that information, you think that information is important? Yeah, because it's the blueprint on how to build your body, but it also controls how these cells function, whether they're going to live or die. So you could consider it like an important computer program. And we don't want that information corrupted, because if it's lost or broken, we can't reload that information. Like your computer, you can always reload a program into your computer if it's not functioning properly. But if that information is lost in the cell, can't reload it, what happens to the cell? Most likely it's going to die. It's going to mutate. Usually it mutates into, right, just a dead cell. So that information is protected by the nuclear envelope. That's the job of the nucleus. It protects all that important information from being corrupted because of all the activity that's happening outside the nucleus. There's a lot happening outside the nucleus. And then lastly, this right here, this dark spot inside the nucleus is called the nucleolus. That is the active form of DNA. This is the active part of the nucleus. And I'll tell you what that means in a little bit. The material that makes up chromosomes is called chromatin. And in order for chromatin to do its job, it has to be found in just really long thread-like filaments. All right? And so when we look at the nucleus, when the cell is doing its everyday job, we don't see any chromosomes. We just see kind of a nice homogeneous mixture of chromatin and the nucleolus right here. So when chromatin is not found in chromosomes, we say that it's extended. So all those miles and miles and miles of chromatin are pulled off of a chromosome so that it can be used to make proteins. And it gives the nucleus just a homogeneous look to it. It looks all the same, except for that little nucleolus right there. All right, so why do you think our cells have all these organelles in there? Let's just think of the big picture. Why do cells have organelles? You've learned all of the individual pieces, all the organelles and what their function is, but why does a cell have all these different pieces? What? Go ahead, say that again. To make life happen? Is that what you're saying? Yeah? Yeah, that's a pretty good idea, right? Because it helps organize the living processes that are happening inside the cell. But let's work with another model. Think of this building as being a cell. And when you walk in this building, what do you see? Is it just one big cave, one big cavity? What do we have inside this building? We got walls and rooms, right? And what's the function of all those different walls and rooms? It just allows a biology class to function right next door to maybe a physics class or an astronomy class without interfering with each other, right? Because if it was just one big room, we'd have mathematics, we'd have anatomy, we'd have physiology, we'd have maybe some English and astronomy and physics. Right, all happening in one big room. We'd have like 10 or 20 instructors all talking at the same time. And you know, that seems really efficient. Let's not tell anybody about this because they'll figure out maybe a way to do it. But so you could sign up for all these classes and graduate in just one semester. Would that be possible? Could you listen to 20 lecturers at one time? No, it'd just be mass confusion, right? So the cell is broken down into organelles so that it can undergo all of these specialized functions without interfering with other important specialized functions that the cell has to undergo to stay alive. Right? So just think of an organelle as being like a special little place in a building so that nothing interferes with each other. All right, that's the job of all these organelles right here. All right, so what is cytoplasm again? Cytoplasm is everything on the inside of the plasma membrane. And it is made out of organelles and cytosol, the fluid part. Okay. And then here's another word that I just kind of made up myself, and that is nucleoplasm. Nucleoplasm is just all the junk that is inside the nucleus. And again, there's chromosomes and there's a fluid part. Okay. So, and we talked about some nuclear structures. What's the nucleolus? That's the active part of the nucleus. All right, nuclear pores are just passageways so that material can enter or leave the nucleus. And that's controlled by the nucleus itself. Chromosomes are made out of DNA. And a basic building block of DNA is what we call a nucleic acid. And there's a way to protect the DNA. Right? And if the strands of DNA are what we call chromatin, and if we want to protect it, we have to wrap it up on some protein molecules. Those protein molecules are what we call histones, and then the DNA is nice and protected. But in order for the cell to use the DNA, it's got to be pulled off the histones in order for you to use it. All right, so another analogy that I think of that kind of explains condensed chromatin versus extended chromatin, say you're going to go on a trip. When? Spring break? Too far away. Sometime sooner. Next week sometime. Okay. So when you go on a trip, what do you take? Towel, your bathing trunks, your razor, your toothbrush, your toothpaste, maybe your contact lenses, hairbrush, couple pairs of pants, shoes, tennis racket, tennis balls. All right, you get on an airplane with all those things in your arms, like that. Well, what would happen if you were trying to go traveling with holding just everything separately like that? What would happen? You'd lose something, right? Okay. So what do? You take all your stuff and you put it in a suitcase. So it's packaged up so that you don't lose it, but if it's in the luggage, can you utilize it? Okay, you can carry it with you very nicely and you won't lose anything, but if you got a tennis racket in there, you can't use the tennis racket until you take it out. All right, so the same thing with chromatin. When it's condensed, when it's packaged in histones, right, your cell can't use it, but it's safe. Right? It's like having all your belongings in a luggage. But in order to use it, we got to take the chromatin off, and it becomes what? Extended, a big, long filament. But when it's extended, guess what? It can be damaged, and we don't want that to happen. So when chromatin is extended, where do we find it? We find it behind the nuclear envelope right here. It's protected by the nuclear envelope. Okay. So let's see what else we want to talk about. Moving across the plasma membrane. Okay, how do things move across the membrane? We got two ways. These are passive transport versus active transport. And I want you to get a feel for what this means. Passive just means that it is a process that will happen automatically. And active means that it's a process that requires energy in order for it to happen. So maybe I have a perfume bottle right here in my hand that's closed, and I take the top off the perfume bottle, and we don't have any fans moving any air around in here. You don't feel a breeze mixing the air up. But if I were to open up a perfume bottle, guess what would happen? Would anybody ever smell that perfume? Yeah, the people in the front row would smell it first, and then the second row and third row. So that perfume molecule is actually going to move from one place to another, and it will move according to a concentration gradient. It's going to move from an area where the concentration is high to an area where it's low. Where is it going to be the lowest? Way in the back. So that's the direction that it's going to move in. All right, so that's a passive process. That process is what we call diffusion. So diffusion is just the movement of some kind of molecule down a concentration gradient from high to low. It doesn't require energy. It's just a magical kind of thing that happens. And osmosis is a special term because probably the most important molecule in our body is water. And water can move from an area of high concentration to low. And if it moves across a membrane, have you ever seen a membrane anywhere? What's the basic structure of a membrane? The phospholipid bilayer, right? So water can move across these membranes if it has a particular channel through it, right? And it's going to move from high concentration to low, and we call that osmosis. So osmosis is a special kind of diffusion. It's only particular to water, and it has to go through a membrane that is selectively permeable, one that doesn't allow everything to move through it. So if we have a cell, and all of a sudden water starts to diffuse in, it osmoses inside the cell, guess what happens to the cell? So if a lot of water goes into the cell, guess what happens to it? It starts to, does it get smaller, stay the same, or get bigger? It gets bigger, right? Like putting air in your tire. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And if your body doesn't know how to control that process, it can get so big that it actually explodes. All right, so we talk about that process a lot in physiology class. That's when something lyses or breaks up. Okay, and so that's a very unhealthy state when your cells start to blow up like that. Okay, active processes require energy. Guess what the energy molecule is? ATP. So most active processes require ATP, so ATP, and that stands for adenosine triphosphate. Tri means how many molecules or atoms? There's three. There's three atoms of phosphate on this molecule, and it can be broken down into ADP, and that D stands for diphosphate. So now how many phosphates are on adenosine? Only two, and so we're left with one phosphate molecule that's out floating around in the cytosol someplace. It was held on by a chemical bond, so that energy that was in this chemical bond is now released for cellular purposes, maybe transport, for instance. Okay, and that energy then can use to drive molecules from low concentration to high. So let's think of that perfume analogy again. So an active process will take perfume from where to where? From the back of the room and stick it where? Back in the bottle, right? That doesn't happen automatically. That requires energy. It's an allowed process. It happens because that's how the perfume got in the bottle in the first place, right? Somebody had to spend energy to get it in there, right? So that's an active process. Some processes that happen, right, that can move things across the cell membrane that are large particles. We can call these phagocytosis, pinocytosis, and exocytosis. And these have to do with vesicles inside the cell. Let me see if I can find maybe an example right here. All right, so here we have this bacterium or other some kind of particle on the outside of the cell. And can you see something about this membrane right here? What can you tell me about the basic nature of this membrane right here? It is a phospholipid bilayer, okay? And when the cell bumps into this particular particle, and it could be a food particle that it wants, it can, using the cytoskeleton, flow around the particle, right, so that the membrane invaginates and forms a dimple, so the particle kind of gets swallowed up. And then this junction right here forms just a complete bridge. So now you have a vesicle found inside the cell that contains this particular particle. So this would be an example of phagocytosis, where something that was on the outside of the cell ends up inside a vesicle inside the cell. And do you think that's an active process or a passive process? That requires energy to move that membrane around. It just doesn't happen automatically. That's phagocytosis. An example of pinocytosis would be the same thing, with the exception that the material that's being brought into the cytoplasm is not a solid material, it's just a fluid material. It's substances that are dissolved in water. So phagocytosis means literally cell eating, and pinocytosis means cell drinking. But in every case, it is active, and it's a way that the cell can take up certain kinds of material. All right, but the reverse can happen. So maybe we have some material inside a vesicle inside the cell. It moves over to the cell membrane, and it fuses with the cell membrane, and now whatever inside the vesicle is released to the outside world or the extracellular space, and that would be an example of exocytosis, something or a secretion of some kind from the cell. And all of those require energy to happen. Okay, so get a little feel for phagocytosis, pinocytosis, and exocytosis. All right, which takes us to protein synthesis. So proteins are one kind of very important biomolecule in your body. And proteins have to be manufactured. They're manufactured in a two-step process. There has to be information that tells how to build a particular protein in your body. And as a matter of fact, probably most of you know this, proteins have a basic building block. Okay? And so I'll ask you, what's the basic building block of a protein? What are they made out of? They're made out of little molecules called amino acids. And there's about 20 amino acids that can be used by your body to make a protein. So when you want a particular protein, your body has to know what amino acid is going to be placed in that long chain. Just like when you spell a word, right, you have to know, like if you want to spell the word, what, anniversary, you have to know what letter comes first, what letter comes second, what letter comes third, and then you spell the word correctly and it has meaning. The same thing for a protein. Every amino acid has to be in the right position of the 20 in order for that protein to do its job. So information is required. And guess where that information is stored? In the nucleus, in the DNA molecule. All right, that's where that information is stored. All right, but what did we say about DNA? Does it ever run around in the cytoplasm? Does it ever run into the rough endoplasmic reticulum where the protein is being made, right? That's a function of rough ER. It makes a protein. Does a chromosome ever touch the rough ER? No, because if it left the nucleus, what could happen? Yeah, it could get broken down. As a matter of fact, it will get snipped to pieces and then you lose the information. So what the cell does is that it takes information in DNA, converts it into kind of a cousin kind of molecule, which we call ribonucleic acid, or RNA. The RNA leaves the nucleus, and then RNA is used to make a protein. So how many steps are there involved in making a protein? How many arrows do you see? Two-step process. The process of converting information from DNA to RNA, that's the first one. The second one is when information is converted from RNA into a protein. All right, so we got to know the names, but also where it takes place. So where does this first step take place? Does it happen in the cytoplasm or does it happen in the nucleus? Why do you say nucleus? Because that's where DNA is. It doesn't ever wander around because it will get killed, right? So this first step happens in the nucleus. The second step, conversion of RNA to protein, happens in the cytoplasm because the RNA actually leaves the nucleus. Now, what organelle is necessary to convert RNA into a protein, to convert the information of RNA into information in a protein? That is the ribosome, right? The ribosome. And we saw that the ribosome can be attached to the endoplasmic reticulum, but you know what else? We can also have ribosomes floating around in the cytoplasm. I see some ribosomes here, here, and here. These are what we call free ribosomes. They make proteins that end up just floating around in the cytosol, right? They are never for secretion. So proteins can have basically two fates. They can end up outside the cell if they're made by the rough endoplasmic reticulum, or the other fate could be that they stay in the cytosol, right, the cytoplasm, if they're made by a free ribosome. So depending on where that ribosome is, the fate of that protein changes. One is for secretion, The other is for just the internal use of the cell. All right. So, what are the, so we said two steps. Oh, what else is important about this diagram right here? What can you tell me about the conversion from RNA to DNA, or from DNA to RNA? What about that step? You see an arrow. And how many points do you see on that arrow? Is it one-way or two-way? It's a one-way arrow. That's really important in this class to appreciate. All right, that information flows in one-way direction. It's a one-way street. All right, and never the reverse. We call that the central dogma of biology. And you're going to learn as you develop and get more sophisticated that's not always true, but for this level, that's a good thing to appreciate. And you should realize why that's such a good thing. Okay, proteins, the information in a protein can't be used to make RNA, which then will change your DNA. And so that's really good. So tonight when you go home and have a chicken dinner, you don't have to worry about waking up in the morning with a beak and feathers because you ate a bunch of chicken protein, right? Eating chicken protein can't change who you are, right? It can make you healthy and strong and stuff like that. But, you know, for millennia, people used to think that just by eating certain kinds of protein, you could become more courageous, right, if you ate lions and things like that. But that's not really true, okay? Because what? Because of the central dogma of biology right here. All right, so let's talk about what the two-step processes are. The first step, transcription. What is transcription? It's the conversion of information from DNA to RNA. Now, where does that happen again? Where does transcription take place? In the nucleus. The second step is what we call translation. Where does translation take place? Nucleus or cytoplasm? Cytoplasm, right. All right, and I don't know, I was confused for decades. Why did they name it these two things until I picked up a dictionary and it made it really obvious? Okay, so if you're ever confused about a term, Google it or just pick up a dictionary and it can save you decades of misery. But what does transcription mean? Okay, maybe you need to go to Admission and Records later today and get a transcript. What does that mean? Basically, it's just a photocopy of the records that are in Admission and Records. So transcription is a photocopy of something. It's basically an exact duplicate, right? So deoxyribonucleic acid and ribonucleic acid are almost the same molecules, right? It's just that RNA is one that can be replaced all the time. So if RNA gets damaged, it's no big deal because the information is still nice and safe in the nucleus. So RNA is basically just a photocopy of the information that's in DNA. The language is the same because the building blocks are nucleotides. It's the same language, just a little bit of a modification. Translation, on the other hand, all right, what does translation mean? When you translate something, what do? Do you just make a photocopy of it? No. Translation means you go from one language to another language. Right, like go from Farsi to German, right? Arabic to Spanish, right? That's translation. But what about the information content? Should it change? No, it should be the same information, just a different language. That's what translation is. And so the second step we call translation because the language of RNA are nucleotides. And what's the language of protein? How are proteins put together? Is it with nucleotides? It's with amino acids. So the language is different, but the information shouldn't get lost. Okay. So that's why they name it these two different steps. So that's the level that I want you to appreciate transcription and translation. Transcription and translation are necessary to make what in your body? Is it necessary to make sugars, lipids, or proteins? Proteins, right? And how many step process is it? Two step. And you got to know the two names and where they occur, and you should have a feel for why they're occurring, right? And that's because you never want your DNA to become damaged. So think of the nucleus as being like the reserve section of the library, okay? That's a protected place in the library. And if you want to get information out of the reserve section, what do? You make a photocopy of it so that you can take it out, and then you don't damage the books that are in there. All right, so next time, you know what? I want to see your pre-lecture assignments, homework assignments, and your study plan. all right? Because otherwise the class is passing you by and you got a test coming up. Okay.